Previously on the Ron Van Dam Show.
You're going to meet the person of your dreams today. I'm very sex-driven, so don't be like, you know, shocked or anything like that. I don't want to deal with that crap.
And now, today's episode.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Good morning. Good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Thank you very much, thank you.
Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Welcome to the program. Hope you're doing well. That's my hope. You have to be at least this tall to listen to the show. It's like Disney World. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Please hold your applause to the end of the program. Thank you. Thank you very much. There'll be a short intermission after the first act, at which time you can go to our cocktail lounge and buy yourself a drink or perhaps have a candy bar. We also validate parking. I've got a very special show for you today. Just can't figure out what it may be. Hey, top of the morning to you. Top of the morning to you. That's my Irish accent. It sucks, I know, but it's the best I've got. Other people do much better Irish accents. St. Patrick's Day, ladies and gentlemen. This is when the Irish gather together and show you how much they can handle their alcohol. That's pretty much it. I stay away from the bars on St. Patrick's Day. Tends to be a lot of drinking going on. Everything turns green. Have you noticed that on St. Patrick's Day? Things that shouldn't be green turn green. Of course, the number one thing is beer. I mean, it's one of the things that I don't want to be green. Drinking green beer it might be festive, but it's just damn odd, that's all. Green to me, to some people, green means fresh green vegetables. You know, to me, green means spoiled and rotten. It does. I mean, like, that's green. Is that supposed to be green? Is that mold? Is that supposed to be green? No. The green food dye industry does very well on St. Patrick's Day because everything's green. They take flowers and they dye them green. People actually walk around with green makeup on. That's attractive. It's one of my fetishes. We were talking about that yesterday. Ron, what attracts you to women? When they're green, that would do it. When they're, a light green, an emerald green, let's say. Irish folklore is very interesting. Irish folklore has a lot to do with luck and winning a lot of money. Absolutely, yes, because there is a leprechaun, and at the end of the rainbow, there's a pot of gold. I think Irish people smoked a lot of pot or something, because, I mean, nice, you know, on lottery tickets, if you win a lot of money, they always have a leprechaun somewhere on the little shamrock guy. like that's good luck. Four-leaf clover. I actually found a four-leaf clover once when I was a kid. Look how my life turned out. Doesn't always work. But go on. I mean, if you drink that much, then you're going to start believing that there are pots of gold at the end of rainbows. I mean, I get it. You know, I've been there, and I think I've seen that too. But then I wake up, and everything's fine. So I don't quite understand that either. And then there's the boiled dinner. Oh, come on. Seriously? Any one of my listeners who are cooks or chefs, and I have quite a few, I tend to understand, We prepare foods in a very creative, classy manner. And then you have boiled dinner. Nothing could be less creative or classy than taking a bunch of shit, throwing it in a pot of boiling water, put the lid on, come back later and eat it. I mean, what? That's not cooking. That's also the way that you clean clothes if you don't have a washing machine. That's not cooking. That's throwing shit in a pot. I'm not degrading Irish food. I'm degrading the way that it's accepted to be made. And then there was the potato famine. I mean, okay, fine. Fine, whatever. I mean, I've gone without potatoes for a couple of days. It wasn't a big deal. Of course, that was quite insensitive, what I just said. The potato famine. I don't know. But I love Irish people. They're all very cute and very attractive, all of them. I know I'm typecasting here and I'm profiling and all that, but Irish people are fairly cute. They have very ruddy complexions. Looks like they just ran a 26-mile marathon. They look exhausted, but they're not. They have a ruddy complexion. And have you ever been to Ireland? It's a beautiful country. It's green and lush. Green again. There you go with the green. It's a beautiful country. And the people are so friendly, man. Oh, it's like you show up and they say, "Hi, my name is Shamrock." And they're very friendly. The first thing they say is, "Would you like to take my daughter out to lunch?" They're very friendly. Very, very nice people. Almost as nice as people in the South. See, people in the South, I mean, you know, they're not. People in the South are very nice, too. I've talked about this before. You know, "Would you like a piece of pie? How are you? Hi, you all. Hi, you all. Would you like a piece of pie? Come on in. Sit down. Take your shoes off. We all got our shoes off. We don't even have shoes. Sit down. Come on. You can be a part of the family. I think I'm your cousin, as a matter of fact. I probably am. That's my husband. He's my cousin. Come on in. Have a piece of pie. Want a piece of pie? Have a piece of pie. Pie's real good. I make a good pie. Hey, have a piece of pie." They're very friendly, but I always feel like it's a phony friendly. It's like overly friendly. It's like going into a place where they're overly friendly to you and you know they just want your money. You know, "Welcome to our restaurant. How are you today? Good to see you. I'm Betty. I'll be your server. And, you look nice. Cold outside, isn't it? Oh, it's so cold outside. I think it's going to warm up, though. You're nice-looking people. Can I get you anything at all? Can I start you out with an appetizer?" All right, Betty, that's enough. That's enough. That's enough, Betty. Here's what's going to happen, Betty. I'm going to order the food, and then you're going to bring it to me, and I'll give you a tip, Betty. Stop with all this friendly stuff like you've known me forever. Please cut it out. I don't need that. We don't need to form a relationship. You don't need to put little pictures of things on a check with little hearts and things and saying thank you when I haven't even tipped you yet. Just bring me the damn food. That's it. Yeah, Betty. Seriously, Betty. But the Irish people are very, very nice. And I think that's a genuine nice. I think they really want to party with you. They're kind of nice. So happy St. Patrick's Day to all. It's the luck of the Irish. And again, so far, I'm not seeing it, but whatever. I could use a little luck of the Irish in my life. But yeah, Irish, nice people, and you know. The other thing that I'll say about the Irish, and this is a comedy routine, don't get down on me for this, please. And other nations do this as well, but the Irish are very well known for it. When they dance the jiggy, what is it called? The Irish jig or whatever that thing is. Why do they dance with their hands stapled to their hips? Why don't they move their arms ever? What kind of dance is that? Here's a dance. I want you to express yourself. Feel free, because dance is an art of expression. But here's the deal. Don't move your arms. Make them as stiff as possible. Make believe they're stapled to your hips and you can't move them. You can use your feet as much as you want. Just go crazy with your feet. I mean, slap your feet and your knees together as much as you want. Just cover as much territory as you want when you're dancing. You can move your head a little bit, not a lot. Go crazy with your legs and your feet, but don't move your arms at all. Never move your arms. How is that an expression of your... I don't get that. Well, that's why they get jiggy with it. I don't know. We do have a guest coming up pretty soon in the program. It's an extended interview today. He's an author. It's an interesting book. It's got a little Irish twist to it. Oh, Ron, you're trying to make it topical. What a cute gesture. Yeah, you know, sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't. Today I do. So happy St. Patrick's Day to you and yours. You and also yours. Whatever yours are, to them as well. I'm not boiling anything. I refuse to boil. I refuse to boil on St. Patrick's. I refuse to fall into that boiling cuisine. What do you feel like today, Bob? Huh. Feel like a hamburger. No problem. I'll make a patty. I'll throw it in a pot of boiling water, and we'll have our little St. Patrick's Day dinner. What do you think? The other thing that they have a lot is cabbage. A lot of cabbage. Cabbage makes me fart. Cabbage is my number one fart component. So what do we have? We have people who enjoy their alcohol, eat a lot of cabbage, and boil everything. This is a recipe for disaster. Someone later in the day is going to get it bad. I woke up yesterday morning in my house, which is where I usually wake up, as opposed to the gutter. I woke up and I have a dog, and I let the dog out in my backyard, and there was this incredible stench of skunk. That skunk, skunks, man, they don't kid around. They let you know they're there. I mean, you think farting is bad? Skunking is like, wow. Skunk is bad. I had a dog about 10 years ago. Dog has since moved on to the great boiling pot in the sky. Had a dog who got skunked by a skunk, and there was no way to get the smell out of this my dog's fur. I mean, it was this. We poured tomato juice. We turned our dog into a reddish pink for about a month, trying to get the smell. We heard the tomato juice takes the smell, skunk smell out. I think someone from the V8 people made up that one, because the tomato juice just turned the dog a different color is all it did. It didn't really work too well. We got de-skunking chemicals, and you know what takes care of the skunk smell? Letting it wear off after like a couple of weeks. That's about the only thing we had to. We didn't let the dog into the house. We left the dog in the basement because it just smelled so much of skunk. It was awful. I had an Uncle Billy when I was growing up. I remember Uncle Billy. He wasn't Irish or anything. I think he was Scottish. And I frequently don't know the difference between the two. And Uncle Billy would sit around and fart continually. It didn't matter what he ate, what he drank. He would just continually fart. And Uncle Billy just kind of didn't have any concept that he was farting. He didn't make noise. There was no warning signal. It's not like sirens were going off. Watch out, here comes a big one. All of a sudden, you'd just be sitting there, and it was like something died somewhere in the closet. There were no warning signals. There was nothing. Nothing. Usually when you hear the sound, you know, oh, okay, in about 30 seconds, we're all going to get it. Let's get the hell out of here. There was nothing. There was no signal. No written warnings. And Uncle Billy tended not to be invited to a lot of family outings. Wonder why? unless they're outside. Then perhaps it was tolerated. But inside the house, Uncle Billy should never show up. When Uncle Billy died, there was so much gas in Uncle Billy that they couldn't close the lid of the casket. It just it was just filled with too much gas. I mean, Billy continued to fart for about 3 months after he died. I don't know how he pulled it off, but he did. What's with the kilt? That's like a Scottish thing, isn't it? The bagpipes? There's an attractive instrument. A bagpipe. That's where you actually take plaid and you put plaid on the musical instrument itself. Very, very odd. Every bagpipe has plaid in it. They love plaid. I don't know why. I don't know what the deal is with plaid with them, but they love the plaid. Let's all look the same. Let's staple our arms to our body, and let's all wear plaid. Sounds like fun. Sounds like fun. bagpipes, yeah. Can't get enough of that. It's bagpipes or get married to somebody that whines a lot. There's no difference between the two sounds whatsoever. I don't want to go. That's bagpipe. Sounds the same. Oh, man. And men wear skirts. They're called kilts. And if you call them skirts, these men all of a sudden take great offense to that, when they should be used to that. But they're basically wearing skirts. And I don't know. I guess if you live in a country where men are wearing skirts, you got to start shaving your legs at some point. I mean, seriously? Come on. Hey, it's a question of what you're used to. Some men have very good looking legs. I got to tell you something. You haven't seen my legs. Wait till the summer comes up. I'll show you my legs. They're attractive. They're very attractive. All right, this is getting kind of weird now. That's getting kind of weird. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a guest coming up who is of Irish persuasion. And he's written a very, very interesting book. I think you're going to enjoy this. We're going to speak to him in just a second. But before we do, this is very, very important. You know, I don't charge you to listen to this show. It's kind of like absolutely free. You don't have to do anything but sit there and shut up. I'm the one that's got to do all the work, and that's a lot for me.
Ain't always easy these days to know what to give your kids for snacks. Sugary this, high fructose that. Heck, even the stuff they call natural ain't always natural. But there's one snack when your kids ask for it, you know exactly what you're giving them.
I want Piggy Parts. I want Piggy Parts.
Professor Parker's preserved Piggy Parts are 100% all-natural salt-preserved pig parts. What parts, you ask? Well, some folks would call them scraps or ears or hoofs, but kids just call them delicious. And with their stiff, leathery texture, one Professor Parker's preserved Piggy Part will last a kid all afternoon. That's what we call value. So stock up now for school. You'll find them at the end of the pet food aisle in original barbecue or vinegar, garlic, teriyaki, onion, habanero, pineapple flavor. Give them a try and you'll see why kids say,
That's some good piggies.
Professor Parker's preserved Piggy Parts.
Roger Higgins joins us now. We've spoken to him before. He's an author. Billy Gogan, Gone for Soldier. This is an interesting novel that has some historical twist to it. How you doing, Roger?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me this morning.
It's a pleasure. Okay, tell us about the book now. Obviously, are you yourself Irish, may I ask, first of all?
No, I'm not. I was born in England.
Okay.
Which makes writing about an Irishman obviously very interesting. My Irish friends all look at me a little bit going, huh? But I seem to have passed muster,
yeah.
Particularly in the... So in the first book, of course, starts in the wake of what was called the repeal year, with Daniel O'Connell failing to obtain Irish liberty from England, because that would have to obviously wait until 1921. But, the second book Billy obviously survives the first book and finds himself a private in the army, the American army, on the eve of the Mexican-American War. And the phrase "gone for soldier" was one that was commonly used, particularly in the Civil War, but somewhat before then, to describe somebody who's signed up to fight, whether on the Union side or to a lesser extent on the Confederate side. And there are songs that we'll talk about. You know, "Johnny's Gone for Soldier."
Yes,
I think that's a very famous one. And so, I decided that that title captured what Billy had was doing in the second book, which, as I said, describes the months just prior to the start of the Mexican-American War,
right,
and the opening few months of the war. And I'm sorry.
No, go on.
Yeah. So, this is a war that still reverberates in American culture and in our political discourse. Because, and I was reading about this the other day, doing some research for the third book, and you know, the historian I was reading said the war's not over. We've got this border. We've got this, there's this dialogue, this engagement between the United States and Mexico that's been going on for 175, 180 years, you know, clearly starting in the days of the 1820s when the first U.S. settlers trickled into what's now eastern Texas with Stephen Austin and, later culminated in the Texas Revolution of 1835, 1836, the Alamo, all of those things that people remember from school. And here we are, 8 or 9 or 10 years later, late 1845, early 1846, Texas has joined the Union, has become a state. People are worried to some extent or another that Mexico is going to invade Texas in one more effort to try and take it back. Certainly they tried a couple of times during the that 10-year period earlier. And so President Polk sends an army to Corpus Christi. And it has all of about 3,400 troops in it, which was almost half the army. That was half the soldiers in the army. And it was just about every soldier that could be sent to go fight because the other ones were on the frontier somewhere, and, you know, couldn't be stripped away. But that's how small the American army was in those days. And, you know, describes the level of effort that, President Polk put into this. And of course, you know, these things began, the army was first called an army of observation. And then, it then becomes an army of invasion, and then an army of occupation during the months leading up to the war and at the beginning of the war.
Yeah.
And there was this debate about the coming war. I mean, You could tell that something was in those months, you could tell that something was going to happen one way or the other. And of course, the Mexicans weren't about to invade Texas, very far from it. They had about, in the middle of 1845, they had fewer than 500 troops in Matamoros. So the geography is that Matamoros is on the south bank of the Rio Grande, about 75 miles inland, insofar as going down the river. Corpus Christi is about 130 miles north, at the bottom of Aransas Bay. And there we are. Billy's an enlisted man, as a private, and, his, company is in the, 4th Infantry Regiment, and his, company officer is this, young fellow, who's just starting to grow a beard, named Ulysses S. Grant. I've heard of him. I think most people will recognize that name. The $50 bill.
If for no other reason.
And Grant was a fascinating figure because he left behind one of the most beautifully written presidential memoirs ever. And in fact, I think it's still even now widely acknowledged as probably the best presidential memoir ever written. And so I get to use that as one of my primary sources.
Do you think that a lot of people, and rightfully so, would be confused that this is actually a novel as opposed to the story of a soldier who actually existed, because kind of a gray line?
Well, it is. I started, and it comes back from the artifice of how I started writing the first book. Mm-hmm. And I made a decision to write this in the first person because, being my first book, it for various reasons, turns out to be easier to control the point of view when you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I turned the vice into a virtue by going, okay, so what are we doing here? What is this? This is the story of an Irishman who becomes an American and then becomes an American soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has the artifice or the structure of being a memoir. And obviously fiction. It's fictional. I mean, clearly, and any author of fiction is going to take some degree of liberty with historical fact.
Yeah.
I'll give you one example is during the Battle of Palo Alto, the American Army, one of its units, this was called Childs's Artillery Battalion. They were artillerymen acting as infantry, had to form a square, it literally was a square, three ranks deep of soldiers and firing their muskets out. And that was the way that infantry in those days, that infantry would face a cavalry charge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you read the book, you'll see that the 4th Infantry is the one that is in the infantry square. And, for some fairly obvious story, for the storytelling effect of what it must have been like to have withstood a cavalry charge.
Mm-hmm.
But, so those are the kinds of things that one can do. But other than that, I mean, it really does, I think, adhere to the warp and the woof of the time and the feel and the experiences. I mean, a lot of what happens in the book is drawn in no small part from the memoirs of people who actually did participate in the war.
Exactly. That's why
both officers and enlisted.
Yeah. That's why it mirrors so well. While we have time, this has been a subject matter that you've written on many times. And I want to talk about immigration very quickly because in the subject matter of the book, we're talking about when there's a question of territory actually being invaded or the possibility thereof and the struggle for territory. We don't have the struggle for territory anymore, although we have quite incredible uprise in immigration talk. Why in your mind would there be so much of this now when we have no territorial situation that we're concerned about?
Well, that goes to, how some things have changed and how some things have remained the same. So what's remained the same is, or was since the end of the war, is you've got this border.
Mm-hmm.
And, before there was a border, there were people living there, both Native Americans, Indians,
right.
And also, a small number, I suppose, but there were Mexican and before them Spanish settlers who had gone as far north as San Francisco. And so, you know, for that century or more after the end of the Mexican-American War, that border area was incredibly fluid. People came and went across it.
Well, as I mean, we have Irish people in New England. And they went as far as Chicago. I mean, you know, it's the same thing. But at the same time, we're not talking about rapists and murderers coming from Ireland.
No, we're not. Yeah. We're talking about people coming to work in the fields, work in America's restaurants. There was I'm trying to remember the name of the film where the artifice is a few years ago now, where the artifice was, what if all the Mexicans disappeared? You know, and you know, the punchline was, well, LA would just simply cease to operate.
Exactly.
And, you know, so I mean, there's a lot of that. But two, you know, there is also, I mean, the thing that's changed today, of course, is there's a lot more people. You know, in 1845, the population of Mexico was, I don't know, call it 7 million.
Yeah.
The United States, about 22 million, something like that, if memory serves correctly.
Right. Okay.
What are we at now? Right. 340 million and about 110 million.
So we're using, so we're comparing it to a parking garage where the level is full. Go to the next level.
Or
wait till a car leaves.
Maybe, or, you know, I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that analogy.
I know. I wasn't sure myself.
Well, you know, but we are still talking about, there are just questions that remain unresolved. Mm-hmm. And so one of the basic questions about, you know, that was facing the country and people like Polk, in, say, the fall of 1845, 6 months before the war started, was, well, if we're going to have a war with Mexico, how much of Mexico are we going to take?
Well,
and there were some, there were some. This is the era of what's called manifest destiny.
Right.
What is America's destiny in the world? And it's, you know, and you know, it is, you know, this is a destiny given to it by God.
Yeah.
You know, by according to the thinking, and so one of the more aggressive positions was, well, we'll take as much of Mexico as we want. We'll take it all the way down to Mexico City and just leave the rest of it. And then there were those who said, no, well, we can't do that because that's too many people who aren't white.
Okay.
We can't have that. We can't have that many foreigners.
Well, that's
we can't afford that many foreigners.
Yeah, that actually seems to be the answer.
Yeah, I mean
The scale is being tipped in some people's minds too far.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Right. And so you know, unsurprisingly, I mean, people talk about this in the book, I tried to adopt. You know, I mean, there are people who wrote letters, they wrote articles, you know, so there's plenty of written evidence about how various people were thinking. And I tried to channel some of that to give the reader a touch of the flavor of the kinds of ideas that were being debated at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you listen very carefully, we're still having those same debates today.
Yeah, I don't think you have to listen too carefully to know that that's going on. Roger, we're running short of time. Billy Gogan is out the next installment, and I'm sure there'll be others. I assume you're working on the next one.
Yes, there is a third one that is in progress and a fourth one.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be a four-book cycle.
Excellent.
That will resolve all the plot lines.
It's like an encyclopedia.
That's my promise to the reader.
Okay. you can Google Roger Higgins, or where can we get more information on you and your plight and the series?
So the first place you can go is my author's my book website called BillyGogan.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's got... quite a bit of material on the books themselves, and also on the times in which Billy was operating.
Yep.
You know, there's pieces on there about the repeal year, about the Great Hunger, about the Five Points, and about the beginning of the Mexican-American War. And there are links there to both Amazon and to Barnes & Noble, where you can buy the book.
Perfect. He's Roger Higgins. You'll hear a lot more about him. It's a hot topic, and now you can kind of look into the past and see where this all came from. Hey, pleasure speaking to you again, Roger. We'll talk to you soon again, I think.
I hope so.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
I'm out of time for today. Until next time, I wish you peace. May the luck of the Irish be with you.